This is Dr. J with Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your radio tuned to the left and your mind in the open position as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking with Brian Hallwyl. He's staff researcher at the World Watch Institute. He's a John Gardner Public Service Fellow from Stanford University and holds a degree in Earth Systems and Biology from Stanford. At the Institute, he researches and writes about issues related to food and agriculture, ranging from organic farming to biotechnology and hunger to water scarcity. Before coming to the Institute, Brian established a student-run organic farm on Stanford University campus and worked throughout California setting up community-supported farms, organic farms and orchards, and assisting farmers who are making the shift from chemical agriculture to organic farming. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be here.
Now, the reason I've contacted you this week is that I want to get to this report that you and World Watch have just released on population trends. And the report comes out at the 200th anniversary of a report on population trends by Thomas Malthus. This is the bicentennial of his work, famous work on that. And so I want you to tell us a little bit about who was Malthus and what did he say and prescribe?
Well, Malthus was a famous clergyman, British clergyman, who around 200 years ago wrote a pretty legendary essay, probably one of the few essays that 200 years after its publication is still being hotly debated throughout the world. And his basic premise, he did say a lot in this essay, it was about 200 pages, but his basic premise was that population would grow geometrically or exponentially, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and so on. Food supply would grow arithmetically, so 1, 2, 3, 4, and eventually he hypothesized that population would outstrip the growth in the food supply, causing widespread misery and famine throughout the world. He felt this was justification to kill off large amounts of poor people in the world, largely in Africa, which was, in his concept, that was the poor part of the world, him being in England, and that would assure that there would be enough food for the wealthier people in Europe.
So Malthus was championed by conservatives of his era, or was he seen as a maverick for his ideas?
He was kind of seen as a maverick, but it fell closely in line with the social Darwinist movement, which was gaining a lot of which would gain momentum several decades later, and so Malthus's ideas were adopted largely by conservatives later on as justification for kind of restricting the use of resources by certain classes of society.
Now, Malthus's findings, his predictions about the future didn't turn out to be terribly accurate. Why was Malthus wrong?
Well, there are probably a number of reasons why Malthus was wrong. And just to make clear, he wasn't completely wrong. We definitely we face a world where nearly a billion people go hungry every day by the most recent estimates from the United Nations and the World Health Organization. These are largely people found in South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and also in sub-Saharan Africa. And the billion people that go hungry every day is roughly the world population at the time when Malthus penned his essay. So that's a little ironic. But there were a few things he didn't predict. He didn't foresee. One was the tremendous gains in land productivity and largely in grain yield that the Green Revolution brought us. And secondly, he didn't see the tremendous gains in other types of agricultural technology, the use of fertilizer, the expansion of irrigated land, which allowed the use of additional fertilizer, the tremendous gains in plant breeding, everything that went into the huge yield gains. So very often, neo-Malthusians, people who will champion Malthus's ideas nowadays, are criticized by, you know, their adversaries who are kind of thought of as the economic optimists, the Julian Simon type people, who say that people today who feel that population is outstripping the supplies of food and water and jobs and whatnot, their opponents will often say that they still, like Malthus, don't take into account the gains in technology, the gains in human ingenuity, and how that can expand the amount of resources and stretch the amount of resources to make them available to the growing population.
Well, that is still a potential critique of any concern about population, isn't it, that unforeseen technological developments in agriculture and other spheres might make population irrelevant?
Sure, it's definitely a valid argument.
Are there reasons why World Watches and other people who are concerned about population today, their concerns are qualitatively different from the concerns of previous eras?
Well, I think one thing that our report, and the name of the report is Beyond Malthus, 16 Dimensions of the Population Challenge. We basically look at 16 different effects of world population growth, and these are effects on various resources and services ranging from food and fresh water to forests, jobs, housing, infectious diseases, political conflict, and basically that while it's true that we haven't seen mass famines worldwide, we do see a quickly declining resource base, a declining quality in the resource base. We still see rampant deforestation. We have a climate system that's constantly being tweaked and maybe reaching a threshold. The first 8 months of 1998 are the hottest 8 months on record, and this is a record that goes back to 1866. And we're also beginning to see certain systems break down, certain national systems break down. As we say, they're falling prey to demographic fatigue. And demographic fatigue is a type of syndrome that can confront a government that's had to deal with decades of rapid population growth. The stresses that rapid population growth can place on a government's fiscal and logistical resources, the challenges of educating huge numbers of young people, the struggle to find jobs for huge additions to the labor pool, the struggle to deal with the adverse ecological effects of population growth, which range from soil erosion to falling water tables to widespread deforestation. And so what we're beginning to see in certain nations in the world is that when a new challenge arises, these governments that are overwhelmed by demographic fatigue often can't cope. And we're beginning to see this, for instance, with HIV/AIDS in Africa. While industrial nations throughout the world have been able to keep infection rates below 1%, for example, the United States has a little under 1% of its population infected with HIV. This is one of the highest rates for an industrial wealthy nation. There are certain nations in Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, South Africa, who have between 20 and 25% of their adult population infected with HIV. And basically what that's leading to is that within the next 5 to 10 years, barring a miracle, these nations will lose a significant chunk of their population to AIDS. And so they will be falling back into an earlier demographic stage in which increased death rates are offsetting increased birth rates, and they essentially have no population growth.
Let's go back through that. There have been reasons for optimism with previous observations of population trends because of the three demographic stages. What were those stages?
Right, I should have made that clear. Very often demographers they like to explain the varying rates in population growth that we see throughout the world. For example, in Europe, you have populations that are largely stable or declining, and in Africa and certain Asian nations, you have populations that are growing quite rapidly, 3 and 4% a year. And so basically, there's this concept that a given population, a given society, will go through three demographic stages. In stage one, birth rates and death rates are high, both high and both offsetting themselves, so there's very little population growth. This is what was going on in the world for the majority of human history, up until around 10,000 years ago. all of a sudden you enter the second demographic stage, or rather, probably till much more recently, until 1900, until the early 20th century. There wasn't a rapid population growth going on in the world. High birth rates and high death rates were balancing each other out. In the second stage, death rates are brought down, and this is through modern advances in medicine, immunization, the reduction in infectious diseases, certain improvements in public hygiene and public health services. And so as death rates come down but birth rates remain high, you can have a period of very rapid population growth. And this happened in the United States. This happened in Europe during the Industrial Revolution. But slowly, you hope, the birth rates will come down, and the nation will enter the third stage, in which birth rates and death rates are both low, and they're offsetting one another, so that population once again has reached a certain type of stability, and you hope that that population, the absolute number of people in that society, is somewhere around the carrying capacity for that population set of resources.
So the final demographic stage is a stable state that we hope to maintain over time and would be a good place to be.
Right, theoretically, and you hope that all nations will make that transition. Most of Europe and Japan are in stage three. There are no countries right now in stage one, in that high birth rate, high death rate stage. Most of the world's nations, including the United States, China, some of the large nations in Africa and Asia, are in stage two. Nations like the United States and China are quickly moving to stage three. Their populations are slowing in growth and they're stabilizing. But there are a lot of large nations in the world, like India, like Nigeria, Ethiopia, Egypt, who are still projected to add many million people to their population in the next 50 years, the next half century. And so the question is whether those nations will be able to move to stage three by lowering birth rates, by quickly shifting to smaller families, or whether some of these nations will slip back into stage one of the demographic transition.
Slip back because of their inability to control their population growth through birth control and their inability to control infectious disease death.
And infectious diseases or other types of challenges that might arise. I mean, we have a situation in India, and India's population is pushing a billion, and the UN projects that by 2050, India will surpass China as the world's most populous nation, going to about 1.6 billion. So this is about an additional half billion people in the next 50 years. And there's widespread water shortages throughout India, especially through some of the northern breadbasket areas, the Punjab, Rajasthan, Haryana. There's been falling water tables there several meters a year for the past several decades. Now, when some of these water tables hit bottom, there will be nothing farmers can do except for cut their pumping of water to the rate of recharge, and currently they're pumping water at many times the rate of recharge, and the increases in food production that India has seen, and which has allowed it to keep a lot of its population just kind of on the brink of subsistence, a lot of that food production will not be available. If they don't cut back in their water pumping, there will be a dramatic cut in their water supply and hence in their food supply in the next several decades. So aquifer depletion is another challenge that a rapidly growing population could come up against and could in effect raise death rates to offset the high birth rates.
Now, some leftists would argue that the population problems that you're pointing to are often the result of the exploitation of the third world by the first world, at least historically or perhaps currently, and that efforts to control population are perhaps racist, that they distract us from redistributive needs, and that the real people that we should be controlling the population of are the first worlders who are consuming 85% of all the resources in the world. Where do you come out on that?
I definitely would agree with them wholeheartedly. We categorize countries in the Malthus paper, we categorize the United States as one of the countries like India, like Nigeria, that really has to get its population growth under control. We were talking about earlier the debate between neo-Malthusians and economic optimists, The neo-Malthusians think that demand is the problem, so they talk about slowing population growth. The economic optimists think that supply is the problem, so they want to encourage innovation, human ingenuity, technological substitution, so that you can increase the supply. But neither of these two, and you'd think that these two are the opposite ends of the spectrum, neither of these two ever speak about structural scarcity, the inequitable distribution that you'd referred to. So they both kind of dodge that issue, even though it seems like they're disagreeing with each other. They're just kind of arguing the different sides of the same coin. And we can take a country like India, and we can look at, I was mentioning shortages in water supply. There are certain large farms in India that pump a tremendous amount of water and have these large industrial wells that go way down. And these are the Green Revolution type farms who are using the modern hybrid varieties, the high yielding varieties with large inputs of chemical fertilizers and synthetic pesticides. These large farms expropriate a huge amount of water, a disproportionately large amount of water. And if there are small neighboring farms that are also pumping water, if these large farms, and they often do have wells that pump deeper, they will deplete the wells of the surrounding smaller farmers. There's a lot of water in India. They've got a lot of people, so there's a lot of stresses on the water, but it's clear that there's a distribution problem. But given the distribution problems, you kind of have to be a little pessimistic to assume they're not going to be cleared up overnight. Slowing the population growth in India is going to make it a lot easier to deal with the inequitable distribution that may be ever present there. At the same time, if you were to clean up the inequitable distribution, and this goes all the way from water to income to provision of health services, then it would make it a lot easier and you'd gain a lot of leeway to deal with a growing population.
So equality and population control can feed back on each other?
Definitely. I mean, what we're talking about in this paper is environmental scarcity. Mm-hmm. And you could have scarcity driven by demographic factors, and you can have scarcity driven by structural factors. They often work together and feed on themselves. If you have you could look at certain situations in the world like the Mideast peace talks are going on now, and one issue that we often don't hear about is the water issue, right? These are the Israelis and the Palestinians. They find themselves in the desert. They largely depend on the Jordan River. There's very little rain in those countries, and basically you need water not only to survive but to fuel your economy. And one thing that people often don't hear is that the Gaza Strip, which is right on the border of the Mediterranean, is downstream from most of Israel with respect to the Jordan River. So by the time the Jordan River flows into these Palestinian settlements, it's basically a trickle of water, just like in the United States. By the time the Colorado River goes into Mexico, it's heavily polluted. It's laced with toxic chemicals and heavy metals from industry, and most of the water's been tapped out. On the one hand, there's very inequitable distribution. At the same time, because of the scarce water resource, very often the people on the downstream side aren't able to move into a kind of a higher development level where they can get universal health care, where they can maintain good nutrition and good sanitation. And that often feeds into the demographic factors where people who are poor and malnourished and might be unemployed, they tend to have larger families. It's a type of trade-off where they don't have access to family planning, they don't have access to contraception, and once their population grows, it just exacerbates that structurally induced scarcity.
I really appreciate your being with us today.
All right, for sure. I appreciate it, too.
People can email you at halweil@worldwatch.org. Hawaii.
Exactly.
And check out the www.worldwatch.org website.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us.
All right, take care, Jay.
Okay. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website www.changesurfer.com.